This is Night Call. Broadcast live with host Russ Gibbs. And tonight's guest, Dr. Royce Hansen, professor, American University, Washington, D.C. Tonight's subject, how can the full value of my vote be protected? You participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Now here's Night Call host, Russ Gibbs.
Hello, night people. This is Gibbs. Standing by in Bethesda, Maryland is Dr. Royce Hansen, Associate Professor of Government at the American University in Washington, D.C. Dr. Hansen has been associated with the Washington Center for Metropolitan Studies and was a candidate for the United States Senate in the last congressional election. If you'd like to ask Dr. Hansen a question on tonight's topic, how can the full value of my vote be protected, or make a comment, give us a call here at Night Call. Our night call number is area code 313-846-6601. Now remember, you may call from anywhere collect. Please make that call station to station. Our night call operator is on duty. Our night call lines are open, and we invite you to join us here on Night Call. That number is area code 313-846-6601. Our topic tonight, how can the full value of my vote be protected? Dr. Hansen, what is wrong with the present apportionment system in the United States today?
Well, there are a number of changes being made in the apportionment system that are making it much more satisfactory than it was just about a year ago, Russ. What had occurred is that over the years, as population had grown in the United States and as people concentrated themselves increasingly in cities and suburban areas, the apportionment of state legislatures had not changed. The result was that in a number of states, a vast majority of the people lived in the cities and in the suburbs, and they were not represented very adequately in their legislatures. The pattern of representation in the legislature reflected the way the population was distributed around the turn of the century. This practice developed, as I indicated, as cities grew, in spite of provisions that existed in state constitutions. For instance, the state of Tennessee had not really reapportioned itself since 1901. Alabama was in a similar situation. The state of Delaware had not been reapportioned since 1897. Some of the states were following their constitutional provisions, but their constitutions never contemplated the kind of population growth and the kind of distribution of population which actually existed.
So actually, it's outdated, our system, then.
Yes, our system was very much outdated, and the effect of this on the entire federal system was beginning to be pretty disastrous. Back in 1955, when President Eisenhower set up the Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations, they reported to him that one of the most serious maladies in the federal system was the apportionment of state legislatures, because they were what we call malapportioned, in that representation did not reflect population. People were beginning to lose confidence in their state government, and the legislatures were believed and actually, I think, were unresponsive to the needs that people had at the local level. Consequently, they kept turning to Washington increasingly to meet the needs that many people felt should have been met at the state and local level.
What does this one man, one vote rule mean?
Well, one man, one vote is actually a slogan that began in England in the 1820s and 1830s. When Parliament was attempting to get rid of the rotten boroughs, it simply means that in a democracy such as we have in England or in the United States, you presume that at some point that every country is entitled to as much political weight, as much political importance as every other person. Now, we know that in practice some people are more active than others, some participate more than others, but one man, one vote simply means that every person ought to have an equal opportunity to make his influence felt in the government, whether he uses that opportunity or not. That is essentially a starting point. Now, this has been something which the United States generally was ahead of England. During colonial days, we first began to realize that representation in our legislature should reflect the number of people who lived in the towns and the colonies. Massachusetts was almost 200 years ahead of the English Parliament in making the General Court representative of the population. And in general, throughout our history, our state legislatures were established. So whether they had one house or two houses, the people were represented in proportion to the number of their occurrence. Now, the Supreme Court, in adopting a rule, which it didn't actually say one man, one vote in the apportionment of state legislatures, it did in the vote for governor or senator or something like that, but what it said was there should be a substantial equality of population among legislative districts so that the weight of every voter is as nearly equal as it's practicable to make it. And this has been shortened into the phrase, again, one man, one vote, to symbolize this basic rule about democratic government that I've been talking about.
Well, we hear a lot about the Dirksen Amendment. Now, what is the Dirksen Amendment?
Well, the Dirksen Amendment is the reaction of the forces that were entrenched in the state legislatures to the suggestion that they ought not be in control of the state government and have full power to decide who gets to be represented and who doesn't get to be represented. This is an amendment to the federal Constitution, which has been sponsored by many groups such as the Farm Bureau and the Legislative Assembly of the Council of State Governments, which is made up of the incumbent legislators who don't want to change because it means some of them are going to lose their seats. It would amend the federal Constitution of the United States to permit one house of a bicameral legislature to be apportioned on a basis other than population if that were approved in a referendum of the people. You see, the people fighting reapportionment essentially have given up on the idea that one house ought to reflect the people. But they say, well, you know, state legislatures are very much like the National Congress. And while this is not quite the case, they say, that being so, in other words, for the sake of argument, that being so, then we ought to have one house that represents population, and to preserve checks and balances in government, we ought to have a second house that represents something else. Let's say it represents acres, it represents geography, it represents groups and interests, something other than population, so that we have the kind of system of checks and balances at the state level as we are presumed to have at the national level. This, and they say this should be allowed if the people in a referendum vote for it. They say, now here's where you have one man, one vote, you see, in the referendum that adopts the system of representation. And this also gets around the most controversial of the Supreme Court decisions on apportionment, the case of Lucas against Colorado, decided to malapportion the state senate in their state, that this could not be permitted by the Constitution, because the Constitution requires in the 14th Amendment the equal protection of the law for every person who lives in the state.
Our guest tonight, Dr. Royce Hansen. Our topic, how can the full value of my vote be protected? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
A highly original sandwich creation, or something that just didn't happen. We planned it that way. We planned it in every detail that you get the best sandwich possible at a Harley store at all times. That's why we've become famous for the Harley burger, the Harley original sandwich, the wonderful imported ham sandwich, a great chicken salad, tuna fish salad that comes from the restaurants that we own on the eastern shore of Maryland and Delaware, the Tidewater Farms. And, of course, you can always buy pizza pies baked fresh right before your eyes, plus that great barbecue sandwich, the steak sandwich, and many, many other sandwich creations that are created exclusively and sold exclusively by Harley's in Baltimore. We bake our own bread, and each one of our sandwiches is on an oven-fresh roll at all times.
You turn to Radio 11. This is WBAL in Baltimore. Time is 17 minutes after 2. Time now to rejoin Night Call.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Hello again, Night People. Our guest tonight on Night Call, Dr. Royce Hansen, Associate Professor of Government at American University in Washington, D.C. Our topic tonight on Night Call, how can the full value of my vote be protected? Now, if you'd like to join us here in Night Call, just give us a buzz at area code 313-846-6601. Now, remember, you may dial us direct. And if you wish, you may make that call collect. You may reverse the charges. Our Night Call operator is on duty, and our Night Call lines are open, so we invite you to join us here on Night Call. What do you think about reapportionment? Do you think it's good, bad? What do you think about the Dirksen Amendment? These are the things we want to hear from you on Night Call. Our number here, area code 313-846-6601. Dr. Hansen, could you explain why the states shouldn't be allowed to reapportion as they wish?
Well, I think that the key element here is that if you're going to have a constitutional democracy, you attempt in that democracy, as Thomas Jefferson argued when he was writing a proposed constitution for Virginia, try to establish certain kinds of constitutional rules that will apply, that will guarantee a continuation of equality beyond any one particular point in time. So the Supreme Court has held, and I quite heartily agree with their holding, that if the 14th Amendment requires equality in the political process as a basic condition for the fairness of that political process, then it makes no sense to say to the state, you must apportion one house of your state legislature on population, but you can do anything you want to the people in the other house of the legislature. You can place it on area. You can place it on the number of trees. You can place base that house on wealth or education, because any one of these devices, if used, becomes a means of discrimination against the people whom you're supposed to be permitting to have an equal participation in the election of the legislature.
Well, under the present system...
I'm sorry?
Under the present system, do minorities have a voice in government then?
Well, under the present system, as it has existed before the courts got into the matter of apportionment, some minorities have had a voice. In fact, some minorities have ruled.
Would this be the rural voice?
Well, in general, it has been the rural voice, yes. But it could be, argued that it's not necessarily a rural voice, but it's sometimes the voice of a special interest. Occasionally, urban-based interests have fought reapportionment because they've felt they could deal more easily with some kinds of rural representatives than they could with the representatives which would be elected from urban areas if representation there were actually increased as it should be. The question, I think, is not will a minority or the minority be represented. It's very difficult to identify in American politics the minority. We have many minorities. We don't have a majority in American politics. Rather, we have a coalition of minorities. What the old pattern of apportionment has permitted is one particular minority to be singled out and to be placed in charge of state government. This, I think, is destructive of both the idea of majority rule on its face and also of the idea of representation of many minorities among the population.
Well, then much of the static that we're getting about reapportionment is really the minorities trying to maintain the status quo, is that it?
Well, a particular minority.
A particular minority, okay, Doctor.
Trying to maintain the status quo. Take my own state in Maryland, for example. About 14% of the population of Maryland has been able to elect a majority of the state Senate. Now, why should any 14% be entitled to elect a majority of anybody? Of a state legislature. And why should it be the 14% of the population that just happens to live in the smallest counties of the state? Why shouldn't it be, let's say, the 17% of the population that are non-white? They have rights. They have problems. They have interests. They're a minority. Or why shouldn't it be Protestant clergymen or Catholics, which are a minority in the state, or why shouldn't it be the League of Women Voters, which is a minority? If you're going to pick out some minority and say this minority is entitled to control one house of the state legislature, it seems to me it must have some kind of intrinsic merit, which is evident to the people who are going to get gypped. So that they can say, well, you know, it's all right for these people. They're better than we are. So it's all right for them to be able to veto anything that we want to do through their control of the second house of the legislature.
Well, Dr. Anson, what chance does the Dirksen Amendment have of getting through the states?
Dirksen Amendment, I don't think, could be ratified if Congress initiated it. See, the Council of State Governments, again, and I point out that it's operating as an arm of the Rottenborough legislatures, which pre-existed the involvement of the courts in this matter, tried to use the backdoor route of amending the federal Constitution. Now, the Constitution provides that it can be amended if Congress initiates an amendment and sends it to the states, and three-fourths of the states, or conventions in three-fourths of the states, ratify the amendment. But it also provides that if two-thirds of the states apply to the Congress shall call a convention for the purpose, a national constitutional convention, for the purpose of proposing amendments to the states, and in which case, if it does, then three-fourths of the states can ratify that amendment, and it becomes a part of the Constitution. Now, that method has never been used in the entire history of the government of the United States. But, and it certainly opens a real Pandora's box, if it were, because a national constitutional convention, if called, would be able not only to look at the apportionment question, if that's the reason Constitution of the United States, go about the unneeded process of completely revamping that document.
Well, now, will the states all have to reapportion under the Supreme Court decision?
Just about every state will have to reapportion. There are a few states that have had pretty good apportionment practices. As far as representation of people is concerned, Oregon, for example, has had a very good apportionment historically, and I think it's taken care of its problem after each census. There's been a little bit of discussion there, but by and large, Oregon's brought itself in line very easily. Every state will have to reapportion if it has not done so on its own volition.
Well, now, how long do you think it will take until all the states have reapportioned?
Most of them will be reapportioned by the elections next year, Russ.
Well, now, aren't some of them fighting it?
Yes. We've been in court for 6 years in the state of Maryland, for example. The Oklahoma legislature fought it very bitterly, and eventually the court ordered a reapportionment there. There are a number of states that have fought it rather strongly, but now most of those, even those that have fought it, have succumbed to litigation, or their governors and their legislatures have realized that this is something that not only had to be done, it's something that ought to be done, and they've responded and met it. It's just a few states in which the courts have had to use their ultimate power to decree a new apportionment plan.
Well, what argument do the foes of reapportionment give in court to keep the status quo?
Well, first of all, they argued that this was a political question and the courts had no business getting into it. They said this was a legislative matter and the legislature should take care of it, and the legislatures in their wisdom had decided not to take care of it, and that's the way it ought to stand. The courts ultimately said under our Constitution there has to be a relief for a wrong that's been done, and this involves voting, and voting and the right to vote has always been protected, and the courts can protect this kind of problem, or can be involved in this kind of problem. Then when they lost the jurisdictional argument, they argued, well, maybe one house ought to be apportioned on the basis of population, but since the United States Senate isn't apportioned on the basis of population, that at least one house of a state legislature ought not be reapportioned. And this has been the essential argument that has been made.
Do you feel that the average citizen, Dr. Hansen, is aware of the inequities in voting in the United States?
Well, I suppose not fully. I think more citizens are aware of the problem now, of course, than they were a few years ago. A lot of citizens were becoming aware, however, of the fact that they were getting shortchanged in their government, that they were paying out sums of taxes to the state government, and they were not being given a fair shake in the allocation of those taxes. Let's say it's road revenues. And they were finding that counties with most of the registered automobiles in the state were getting only a small fraction of the state road budget or something of this nature. And the shoe was beginning to pinch, and this is why they're began to be a considerable popular outcry. People who've been concerned with the vitality of state government, of course, have been interested in this problem for at least 30 years.
Do you think that the states, when they do reapportion, that we will go the opposite way, from having one minority controlling to maybe the minority, or in this case, maybe it's the majority of people that live in the city?
Well, there's no state in the country now in which a majority of citizens live in any one city. Also, this is one of the arguments that the advocates of the Durkin Amendment make, with which I profoundly disagree, and that is that this is going to mean, essentially mob rule. It's going to mean that these compact masses of people who live in cities are going to run the state. Well, in the first place, cities are not very homogeneous as far as their population characteristics are concerned. have lost the day in which they would have been ascendant in state politics. We've skipped that, and we've moved essentially from rural domination to the period in which the suburbs will be the statistically dominant element in state government. I say statistically dominant because the suburbs, again, are fairly complex. They include highly compact urban parts, fairly dispersed parts, and then rural fringe areas. So what I anticipate developing in the newly reapportioned state legislatures is a whole new system of alliances between some city people, some suburban people, and some rural people.
Our guest tonight, Dr. Royce Hansen. Our topic, how can the full value of my vote be protected? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Russ Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Want to know something?
Yeah.
Read the news, American.
Want to know something?
Yeah.
Read the news, American.
An unbeatable, readable, lively style that gives you the most by a Baltimore mile. Want to know something?
Yeah.
Read the news, American.
Say you want to sell something. Well, do it the quick and easy way with the News American One ad. The News American reaches more people than any other Baltimore daily newspaper. So your ad reaches more people. And we even help you write it. Call Plaza 2-1212, ask for Miss Joy, and your ad's as good as written. And best of all, the News American is your most economical one ad buy. So call any time before 3 p.m. Saturday to make Sunday's paper. The number again, Plaza 2-1212.
That's the Baltimore News American.
You're tuned to Radio 11. This is WBAL Baltimore, where we'll have more music on the all-night show beginning at 3:05. Now, back once again to tonight's presentation of Night Call.
This Sunday.
I'm playing golf.
Here is host Russ Gibb.
Hello again, night people. And it's Friday night, one of those wild nights. Our guest tonight is Dr. Royce Hansen. Our topic, how can the full value of my vote be protected? If you'd like to join us here on Night Call, give us a buzz at area code 313-846-6601. Now, remember, you may call from anywhere, collect. You may reverse the charges. Please make that call station to station. Our Night Call number, area code 313-846-6601. Now, our Night Call operator is on duty. Our lines are open, and we invite you to join us here on Night Call. Do you think that you're getting full value for your vote? Do you feel that reapportionment is the thing? Do you think that possibly cities are going to take over the government? Or do you think that rural interests should dominate our government? These are some of the questions that we're posing on Night Call tonight, and we'd like to hear what you think about them. Area code 313-846-6601. Dr. Hansen, we just got into the topic before the break on cities and the fear that some people have of city government. Why do we have this cultural fear of cities in America?
Well, this is one of the, I guess, strongest phenomenon in American political culture. We started out as a country that was very non-urban in character, and it was not until about 1920 that a majority of the people of the country actually began to live in cities. We had for the first century and a half of our national development, and then before that, almost 200 years of status, or 150 years of status as a colony, in which we had a vast frontier. And the frontier pretty much captured our imagination instead of the city. And then we have our intellectual folk heroes, such as Thomas Jefferson, who argued the superiority of the agrarian life over city life, so that we sort of have the image in America that the hardy frontiersman is the best sort of person, the rugged individualist, and that the cities are places that are filled with sort of crowded and huddled masses and people of a lower mental capacity and people who aren't as well educated, they're not as highly cultured and as highly civilized as the people who live on farms. Well, you know, there's no foundation in fact for this, but the myth tends to continue.
Well, Doctor, wouldn't it be true to say that if the reapportionment goes through, that we'll have a situation where the Democrats will take over the majority of state governments because we tend to associate the Democrats with city government?
I don't think this can be said with any degree of certainty at all. In fact, some Republicans I know are very much interested in reapportionment because they believe that with most of the seats going to the suburbs, the Republicans are likely greatly to increase their capacity to elect state legislatures. Part of this depends on how the apportionment is carried out. The Supreme Court has required really very little when it's required substantial equality of population among districts. You see, if the existing legislatures are Democratic, I think that the future legislature is more likely to be Democratic, and if the existing legislature is Republican, the future legislature is more likely to be composed of that party.
Dr. Hansen, I have a caller in Indianapolis now, a listener on WFBM, Mrs. Mary Holman. Good evening, Mary. Speak right up. You're on Night Call.
Thank you. I happen to live in a state where reapportionment was ordered by the court, and it turned out that the Senate passed four plans, and the House passed four plans, which seems to me a bit ridiculous. And the court is
God.
Wouldn't you think?
I can't quite hear, Russ.
Okay. Mary, I can hear you, so go ahead with your question, please.
Don't you think that we somehow made a mistake in picking the persons who are now making the decisions?
In other words, are you asking, Mary, whether or not that the people that have decided on reapportionment, that these...
Oh, wait, it's the court.
I'm sorry, I don't follow you then, Mary. Can you restate your question?
The court ordered it.
The court has ordered it. You feel that the people in the courts are wrong?
No. A special session was held. And they have passed, as I understand it.
Legislatures passed more than one plan?
Four plans in one house, in the Senate, four in the House.
Mm-hmm.
Which adds up to eight plans, and the court is to pick the one.
The court then must choose which one it will go into effect?
Which one they will accept, if any.
Yes.
And don't you think people of the state are being given a raw deal?
Yes, I think when the legislature does this, the people of the state are certainly being given the runaround. It seems to me that a legislature has an obligation to enact a plan that it believes will meet constitutional standards. To say this is what we would like to do within the basic guidelines that have been laid down by the courts as an interpretation of the federal constitution. But
I'm sorry.
New York what we're going to do. We're going to give you these four plans, and if you knock down one, why, then you come down to the next one, and if you knock down the next one, you come down to the next one, and finally to the last one, which is the one we think you'll probably uphold, and I believe that's what the court did there. The legislature in my own state, in Maryland, did a similar thing. It passed a plan that everybody believes is constitutional, and one that everybody believes is unconstitutional. I don't think this does the legislature a bit of good. It simply means that after years of carping about the courts getting involved in this, they turn around and abdicate their responsibility to the courts. I don't think this is very good procedure.
Well, here, the plan they passed was unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
They were given an opportunity. And here is what we have come up with, 8 plans.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that is right.
Well, Mary, I want to thank you for your opinion. Thank you for calling Night Call.
Thank you.
This is Mary Holman from Indianapolis, Indiana, a lady who doesn't believe that they're doing justice out in Indianapolis or Indiana with their reapportionment. I have a caller now, Doctor, in Denver, Colorado, a listener on KTLN, Mr. David Adams. Good evening, David. Speak right up. You're on Night Call, sir.
Good evening, Mr. Gibbs.
How are you tonight, Dave?
Good evening, Dr. Hanson.
Good evening.
I have several questions I'd like to ask Dr. Hanson, please.
All right.
Dr. Hanson, for the sake of brief debate, why should I vote as an individual? And also, I would like to know, is voting a privilege or a right? I'd also like to know your opinion on, should a person vote for what a person running, on the ticket, a person running for what they will give you, or should an individual check the issues of this person, what they stand for, not so much as what they're offering? Because usually the more they offer, the more chances they have of winning their election.
Let's back up a minute before I forget all your questions.
Okay, the first question, why should I vote?
Well, I think you should vote because your vote is the one basic guarantee that you have that allows you to protect yourself equally with every other citizen in the country, or in your state or city. Sometimes I grant you that it seems like your vote isn't very valuable, but when you consider the importance that a single vote can have in even directing the way that the country will move, and how the government of your country will be organized, and some of the kinds of policies that might follow, I would say that a person certainly should vote. He should consider his vote one of the most precious things that he has in his country, and one of the most basic protections that he has. The vote can, of course, be perverted. It can be misused. There's no guarantee that it will be used properly, but if people understand or try to make an effort to understand what they're voting for whom they're voting, then I think the vote is an extremely effective instrument of control over government. It's the way you have your voice in politics.
Dr. Hanson, do most Americans use their votes?
Yes, most Americans use their vote. There's still a fairly substantial number of Americans who don't. Some estimate that there are as many as 40 million Americans who could vote who do not. In general, we feel this is unfortunate. We think that democracy would be much more vital if everybody who's entitled to vote would inform themselves basically of who's running, what's at stake, and exercise their vote.
Dr. Hanson, it's time to take a break. And David, can you stay on the line for a few minutes, please? Okay.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Royce Hanson. Our topic, how can the full value of my vote be protected? You're tuned to the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, where you participate by calling Night Call's national phone number, 313-846-6601. Host Ruff Gibb will return in 70 seconds with more Night Call.
Come on over to our house. Where's our house? Well, that's the Harley sandwich stores in Baltimore. There's several of them. So you pick out the Harley house that happens to be in your area. The Harley burger, the Harley original sandwich, the wonderful imported ham sandwich, chicken salad, tuna fish salad from the Tidewater Farms restaurants on the eastern shore of Maryland and Delaware. A great, great menu for you, sandwich-wise. So, if you're wise, you'll stop by the outstanding stores, sandwich stores, in the big sandwich field. We're the inventors of most of them. So you would naturally assume you're getting the best when you go to Harley's, and we'll try to prove that to you. Each individual sandwich on an oven-fresh roll.
You tuned to Radio 11. This is WBAL in Baltimore. Time is now 13 minutes until 3 o'clock. News coming along at 3, followed by the all-night show till 5 this morning. Once again, WBAL rejoins the Night Call Network.
This is Night Call, and here is host, Russ Gibb.
Hello again, Night People. Our guest tonight is Dr. Royce Hansen, and Dr. Hansen is Associate Professor of Government at American University in Washington, D.C. Our topic, how can the full value of my vote be protected? Now, if you have an opinion on your vote, is your vote being used, or is your voice being heard in government, give us a call here at Night Call. Now, our number is area code 313-846-6601. Now, you may dial us direct, and if you wish, you may make that call collect. You may reverse the charges. Our Night Call number, area code 313-846-6601. We invite you to join us here on Night Call. And just before the break, we had a caller from Denver, Colorado, who is still on the line, Mr. David Adams. He's listening on KTLN. And I would ask David if you would re-ask that second question that you had, Dave.
Yes, I'd like to know Dr. Hansen's opinion on whether voting is actually a right or a privilege.
I think that voting is both a right and a privilege. I don't think it's a matter of either or. I think voting is a right of citizenship in a democratic system. I think that It once was considered a privilege. It was a privilege that was granted by a king or something. In a democracy, it's a privilege that's granted by us. We say that this is the way that we're able to control our government. In this way, it becomes a very basic civil right. You not only have a right to vote, you have a right to have your vote counted, and to have your vote counted equally with every other person who votes.
By privilege, I'm referring to that. Don't you think we should have some type of standard in order to vote? Like, for instance, if a person only knows how to sign an X, or he doesn't know how to read or write or know any of the issues, all he knows how to do is pull a lever, anybody could mislead him. Don't you think we should have, say, some standard of where a person should at least, say, have a 6th or 7th grade education and have some little background? In other words, what I'm saying is, even though this is America, I don't feel you were born with the right to vote. It is acquired by your interests, by the initiatives you have. Like you say, only 60% of our eligible voters control our Congress and our Senate and our legislature, both in the federal government and the state. And why is it that the other people are so disinterested in voting? What can I do as an individual to encourage other people that it's worthwhile to get out and vote?
Let me try to divide your question first as to whether there ought to be some kind of standard that would deny the privilege of voting to some people. Let me suggest a couple of alternative ideas to you, David. One is that voting is not something that requires a great deal of education or enlightenment. Voting is essentially a question of judgment. For that reason, I think the basic standard of age that we use is a reasonable one. Now, I personally think that we could, in the United States, lower the voting age without any considerable damage being done, and in fact, it might do some to begin to get people to participate in civic affairs a little bit earlier. But I don't believe that we ought to set an educational qualification for voting. I know a number of people who are far less educated than others who may have very good political judgment. My parents, for example, are not nearly as well educated as I am. My father only has a fourth grade education. And yet I find that my father has a very acute political judgment. He's able to sense, sometimes I think as well or better than I am. I have almost 20 years of formal education. The capacity of certain people to do what they suggest they're going to do. We vote in part by people, in part by party, in part by the kind of interest that we have. And personal maturity, it seems to me, is a far more important criterion than years of formal education or something of this nature. And because
I saw a show tonight called Teenage Rebellion on TV, and we have about 22 million teenagers. So if you lowered the voting age to 18, we would have the teenagers monopolize as far as our politics, as well as they're already monopolizing the trend in dress and fashion and all this. And oh, maybe I'm just a cynical person because I'm not a teenager, but I think that the teenagers are going a little too far myself, or maybe, what do you think of that?
Well, David, could we postpone that for about a week or so?
I'm not an authority on teenagers. I don't get them until they're almost out of their teens.
Dave, we're going
to
be talking...
Anyway.
Yes, Dave, we're going to be talking about teenagers here in a few weeks again on Night Call, and I want to thank you for calling.
Thank you.
David Adams from Denver, Colorado, a listener on KTLN. And now let's go out to Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL, Mr. Bob Etter. Good evening, Bob. Speak right up. Your comment, please, sir.
Hello.
Yes, sir.
Yes. My name is Bobby here in Baltimore.
Yes, you're on, sir.
Hello.
You're on. Your comment, please.
My name is Bob Eater here in Baltimore. I'd like to ask a question, you know, concerning Madeline Murray. You know who Madeline Murray is, you know.
The atheist.
Yes. Well, don't say it that way. It was a lady who sort of sparked the enterprise that caused a great deal of change. Now, she is down in Mexico now. She's got married again. Or she just got married. And, she claims that she comes back to Maryland, which is where I am, that people will sort of hurt her or threaten her. Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that what she stood for by separation of church and state, I think that the philosophy of church and state is very good, in as much as that if you take a child, for instance, any child, and he could be anything from Buddhist, Catholic, Jewish, anything. Now,
well, Bob, is this question directed on the vote issue?
I can't hardly hear you.
Bob, are you asking a question about the vote issue? That's our topic tonight.
Yes, it's a question.
I see.
Whether or not we have a right, you see, whether a right... Well, in other words, I can't hardly hear you there, but do we have a right here? Does she have a right or does she have a right? Or what is right is what I'm trying to get across.
Dr. Hansen, did you get the question?
I'm not sure that I did. I think it relates to whether a person who disagrees with the majority has a right, and this can be related in part, I think, to the vote issue. Does a person who has who disagrees with the way the majority may feel have a right to political expression? And I would say such a person certainly does. I personally take the position of both Jefferson and Voltaire that no matter how odious somebody's opinion may be to me personally, I feel that they've got the right to be protected in the expression of that opinion.
Bob, I want to thank you for calling. calling Night Call. Mr. Bob Etter from Baltimore, Maryland, a listener on WBAL. And now let's go out to Denver, and we have a few minutes remaining, and Mrs. Marguerite Sellinger, and she's listening on KTLN. Hello, Mrs. Sellinger.
Yes.
How are you tonight?
Very good, thank you.
Your comment, please, ma'am.
I would like to ask Dr. Hansen, first I'd like to make a statement of how I feel. For 190 years, our Constitution gave the right of the state to set, to regulate how their representatives would be elected, and it also gave the state the right to set up the requirements for vote, for the right to vote. And now, for 190 years, this was recognized as the law of the land, that this was something that was the right of the state to determine, and that the United States government had no voice in it. They were restricted. They were told what they could do, and everything else was not within their province. And I disagree with Dr. Hansen's idea as to why the people are fearful of this change of vote. In my own case, I am fearful of the city machine. I lived in a suburb of Chicago. I know what a city machine is like, and I think that many others throughout the state are just as upset about city machines taking over the entire state.
Dr. Hansen, you have about 30 seconds to make a comment on Marguerite's comment.
First, for about 190 years, it was not essentially a matter of the federal government not having the power to step in, but not using the power to step in voting cases. As far as the question of city machines are concerned, there are a lot of things that I fear, too. But I believe in a democratic process, and I would hope that I'm able, and people who agree with me are able, to get elected to government. If we have an equal chance to do it, those people who will represent our interests and will not operate through a machine system. It essentially is a matter of whether you have faith in the democratic process or whether you're allowed to be ruled by your fears of what might happen if you use that process.
Well, Marguerite and Dr. Hansen, we're just about finished with time on Night Call tonight. I want to thank you, Mrs. Sellinger, for calling Night Call.
I wanted to tell him that we had voted just prior to this Supreme...
Marguerite, I don't even have time for that. I'm sorry.
Thank you.
Good night. Thank you for calling. A lady from Denver, Colorado, listening on KTLN. And Dr. Hansen, I want to thank you for being our guest on Night Call tonight.
I've enjoyed it.
Our guest tonight is Dr. Royce Hansen from the American University in Washington, D.C. Our topic, how can the full value of my vote be protected? Monday night, we start a new series on Night Call. Our topic, can an American woman be a woman today? Until Monday night, then, this is Gibb wishing you good luck and Godspeed.
Night Call is produced by the Methodist Church in cooperation with the National Council of Churches and this radio station as a radio forum dedicated to the frank discussion of vital issues of daily life. Night Call encourages its participants to express freely and responsibly their own personal opinions.